Hi, my name is Zoe. I'm a nicotine addict, and it's good to be here tonight, and it's good to be clean, and I appreciate to have an opportunity to express my gratitude. I'd like to thank Ken for asking me to share, and the group for having me, and even though I kind of volunteered, I still thank Ken for being here, for his service. And what I'm going to do first is put my time up. I have been free for nicotine, from nicotine rather, for 13 years, 8 months, 7 days, 9 hours, and 44 minutes, which has extended my life expectancy by 694 days and 8 hours by not using 199,976 nicotine delivery devices. That would have cost me $123,659. And I put them up because what is it? Time shared is hope shared or something. And hopefully someone will get something out of that. This thing works. That's what I hope you get out of that. Like, you might not like what I've got to say today, but when you look at those stats, you might think, yeah, it works. And the first thing I say is, if you don't like what I've got to say today and you're not inspired, please go to another meeting and listen to someone else and keep coming back, because I am not representative of Nicotine Anonymous. I'm one person. But having said that, I like what I've got to say. I like it. I like who I am. And that's not boasting. It's called being quietly confident. And that's actually something that I had to learn how to do, because I could never, ever in my past have the humility to be able to just tell the truth about myself. I was always digging myself under the rock. I was the worst person in the room. So, it's a lie. It's a manipulation, and I'm not doing it today. So to qualify, I could sit here and talk about me and my feelings all day. We'll turn this into a therapy session. I don't like therapy sessions in 12-step meetings. So I'll qualify. I'll talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, and what I was like was powerless over nicotine. It's that simple. But that's boring if I left it there. So I fill in a few details. And my first cigarette was given to me by my abuser. And I was at a Deep Purple concert, and I was 10 years old. So with my sister, and there you go, like right there, it's unpacked what she was like. 10 years old, she's dragging me along to a Deep Purple concert. I think she had a few issues, my sister. And I'm standing there and already overwhelmed and just got no idea what's going on. There's just these four giants up there playing these bizarre instruments, and my head's bouncing all over the place, like, oh, I want to get out of here. And she turns around and puts this white stick in my mouth and lights it. And I was like, whoa! And I'm bouncing all over the place, and I'm down on the ground, and I swear I went every colour of the rainbow and felt, I remember the nauseous and lying there, and all her friends were laughing at me, and because they're very abusive people, and I was coughing something up and I couldn't breathe and I couldn't hear, and I was angry and hurt and humiliated. And at the same time, I thought, if I don't die and I can get up, I'm going to do this again. It was just so wonderful. Wow! And I was like, she just became the best sister in the world. And so she didn't have to try too hard to give me the second cigarette. It went down pretty quick. And that really just tells my whole story. I worked out when I went through the steps from that, just that one day, that one cigarette, rather, that I'm an addict. I'm not just a smoker because of the effect that it had on me. I think most people who weren't addicts would have got out of that and just tried anything to make sure that they weren't going to have another cigarette. But I chased it. I chased her. And in the end, she was hiding the cigarettes from me. And I loved it. And I probably, the reason why I smoke hard, I believe, is I'm an alcoholic, and I won't go into that here. I won't go into some big diatribe about that here, because it gets confusing. If you're not an alcoholic, you won't relate, and this is Nicotine Anonymous. But I tell this part of the story just in case there is someone here who is also an alcoholic. I believe the reason why I smoked so hard is because I wasn't drinking yet. And so what I was doing was smoking my alcohol. So I really believe that. So, yeah, I smoked pretty hard, and I stole her cigarettes, and I stole most people's cigarettes. And I noticed a few things changing in my life almost straight away. School became a lot easier. My family became a lot easier. I lived in extreme domestic, not just domestic violence, but it was quite extreme. And I just kind of like, who cares, you know? And my father would be beating me. I'd be on the ground and I'd have blood in my mouth. And I, you know, and hear those words, I was stupid and I was a slut and all that stuff. And it just like washed over me all of a sudden. I was like, who cares, you're dumb. And I just had, what I had was perspective. And I could look at him and just see him for who he was and just know that there was nothing he could do to hurt me because it was all on him. And I don't know, you know, it was like nicotine. It was just like this psychologist that moved into my life, you know, and I just look and go, no worries. The minute I'm old enough, I'm out of here. And I was. And I don't think, that if I hadn't discovered nicotine, I wouldn't have been able to do that because the nicotine treated it. And if you're an addict, you know about it, that thing inside of you that is just itching to get out, and I give it some nicotine, it just shuts up, and then I can think, and they call it fight or flight. I call it selfishness and self-centeredness. I was so wrapped up in myself, and I was just so, like, my father was beating me, but I was more worried about what people were going to, you know, if I was going to look bad when I went to school, and then I drank with him. So the nicotine just gave me freedom from the bondage of self, freedom from the bondage of suey, and I was able to just get up and walk out of there one day. I started trying to get out of there when I was about 11, but made a real serious attempt at 16, and I really believe it was because I discovered nicotine. It was like, gave me power, and I was just out of there, and I hit the street, and I loved it. Oh, I loved it. I loved the nightlife, and I loved being around all the other drug addicts and alcoholics, because not everyone, in my view, what I remember of it, is not everyone that's living on the street is an alcoholic or an addict, and, you know, because they just stay away from me. It was like, danger, and they just run, and because I was, you know, we're hopeless when we're on the street, because, you know, I'm not going to take responsibility for squat, and it's not a good place to be when you're a complete irresponsible, you know, like people want you to do stuff like beg for money to buy food, and I just sit there and smoke and drink and make someone else go do it, and eventually that pisses a lot, you know, enough people off that you just get left alone, and it's not good to be alone on the street because that's really dangerous. So I just loved it. I, like I said, I just found all the addicts and alcoholics, and I hung out with them, and I've got a lot of memories of living in hotel rooms above pubs, and just lying in bed with a bottle of booze and a packet of cigarettes, and just, you know, filling that room up like I was living in some kind of chimney, and just fill it up with smoke until I couldn't breathe, and I'd run out of cigarettes, and I felt like my world had just stopped, and I just couldn't stand it. And that's why I'd have a boyfriend. And I thought, one of the main reasons I had a boyfriend was because they smoked. And it meant, you know, if I ran out, I could smoke. And so, yeah, I didn't really care for much else in life, but the drug, because I wanted the pleasure. You know, that's what I'm really looking for, is the pleasure. Because what's happening is, as I said, I grew up in domestic violence, but that's not what makes me smoke. What makes me smoke is my relationship to it. They hurt me and I become resentful and I keep score and I hold that pain inside of me. And that puts distance between me and you and everyone else around me. And when I've got that distance, I start to yearn and I want to get connected to something. And what I really should have done was connected to something in some kind of sort of spirituality, but I didn't. I turned to nicotine, and that's why I believe it had such a huge effect on me, because it woke me up, it turned the lights on, and I could breathe and I could talk. It was like, you know, my sponsor said it was a lubricant that just brings your head right out of your ass, and he was right. I really believe that, because I watched in the early recovery and I could not breathe. I couldn't walk and I couldn't talk. I couldn't get out of bed. And it finally occurred to me after a lot of conversations with him is that I was self-involved. I was paralyzed in self because I was overthinking everything and just caught up in my head. And I was like that through most of my life, but the nicotine was, you know, it was helping me, it was masking it. And so I spent a lot of time on the street, and then I tried getting off the street, and I couldn't. And the other kids did, like, you know, they went through like child services and stuff like that, and I couldn't, because I'd get there, I'd go to child services, and you know, like all the like the women's shelters and stuff like that, and they'd want to have conversations with me, and right there, and you know, I'll sleep on the street because I can't pull it off because I'm self-involved and I'm demanding, and I just demand that they give me a bed for the night. Of course, I'd get thrown out, and I, you know, lie on the street and that big bed of self-pity, and eventually, I was on the street. Because I'd been traumatized and I had no idea how to live my life. But I believe what happens is that the addiction, being an addict, puts a twist on it. And I can't see the truth. I've got no perspective, and it's everybody's fault and it's their fault. And so there's just no success, you know, like there has to be some kind of, like, you got to move on, you know. And I don't, because I just keep failing, you know. Self-will fails us. It just doesn't work. And so it took a long, long time for me to get off the street. And so it meant that I was subject to being very heavy, because I didn't have to be accountable to anyone. I didn't have a job. I didn't have family. There was no accountability, so I could smoke until I was dead, and it was perfect, and I loved it. And I used to just walk the streets during the day and smoke, and I was, oh, it was like, this is it. And I was smoking Alpine. And because no one smoked Alpine, and then that way my cigarettes wouldn't get stolen. That's why I did that. Or I'd smoke Camel, and it really did feel like I was smoking a Camel. And because I didn't want anyone stealing them, because I just hated anyone stealing my stuff. I didn't mind stealing yours. I did that a lot. I was your friend if you smoked, and sit down at the table with you at the nightclub, and look, there's that guy you like. Oh, where? Oh, God, there you go. There goes your cigarettes, you know. And I just, because I'm not going to buy them, because it's like, you know, I'm entitled to this stuff, so I'll buy it as little as possible. So my life just fell apart because of me and because of my relationship to nicotine. And it seems to me that the harder one tries to get control over their life, the worse it gets. And I tried and I tried and I tried on my own for a very long time to try to get some kind of control, and I couldn't. And one day I turned around and I was on my own. I was a stripper. I was working here in Australia. There's a place called King's Cross in Sydney, and they made the change rooms non-smoking. And that was the first time it hit me, the level of this problem, just how much it was really controlling my life. I was sitting in that change room and I had a job. My rent was over $100 a week, which was a lot of money back in the 80s. And my costumes were costing me thousands of dollars. I owed money. I owed money to my drug dealer. I needed that job. And if I lost it, I'd be on the street. And to be on the street in the Cross meant death. A lot of people died there. It was quite often you'd see the ambulance coming. You know, I don't have to unpack it. Most people are aware of what happens. And yet I sat there and I nearly quit over it because I could not see myself going 8 hours. You know, like once you got off stage, what I used to do was just sit backstage in my change room and drink alcohol and smoke. And now I was going to have to leave that change room and go out on the street if I wanted to smoke, I was almost going to quit. And that means that I put nicotine over and above everything, that I put that hit, that rush, that relationship that I've got with it over and above everything. And I'm willing to die to keep it. And I actually read something this morning that said that addiction starts out as pleasure, and if you keep on doing it, it turns into a necessity and all the pleasure's gone. And that's exactly what happened to me. The pleasure went and it became a necessity, and I had to smoke, and that meant that everything else had to go. And I managed to keep that job, because I found a hole in the wall that I could blow the smoke into so that I wouldn't get caught. And the length that I went to cover that smoking up was phenomenal. Like, you know, air fresheners and cutting the wires on the smoke alarms and making the hole bigger and, it, you know, just... And all I had to do was walk outside, but I, you know, I didn't want it. It was too far. So I really, as an addict, go to any length to keep that addiction going. And then I tried to stop. I got out of the cross and I came back here and I started to bleed. My throat was bleeding constantly and I tried to stop. And that's when I really got the full story of this thing, and I one day I turned around and I said, that's my last cigarette, and I was stunned that 10 minutes later I had a cigarette in my hand, and I could not believe it, because here I was traveling all over Australia and making all of this money and having this strong will in every other area of my life, yet this little white stick had more power over me than anything else. How did it have all of this power? Why can't I just leave it down? Why can't I just make the decision to quit and leave it there? And the other reason I wanted to quit was because of being a stripper, I needed my lungs to dance, and I was getting a bit older. I was late teens, you know, it's old, and I couldn't breathe while I was on stage, and I was losing jobs because of it, and I had to quit. I had to, because I had to keep stripping because I had no other income, yet I did it, and I found a way, and I went to a doctor and got asthma inhalers, and the other thing I started doing was snorting cocaine so that I could smoke. I mean, that's just bizarre. Now, I call that nickologic, when you're snorting cocaine so you can smoke, you know, like, no worries. Like, just don't leave me alone with your kids. Like, God, what a wanker. And I did. I was actually, that's one of the reasons why I started snorting cocaine, because I came off stage one night and the other women in the change room said, this will help you breathe. And I'm like, all I had to do was stop smoking. And because I couldn't give up the stripping because of the situation I was in, like I was, you know, working my way out of it. And so that's what I did. I snorted cocaine to keep my, so that I could keep smoking. And so, you know, that just tells me volumes about this addiction, that we will place our actual lives on the table to keep smoking. So eventually what happened was I hit bottom, a real big bottom with it. And I was, my bottom was the first time I did what was required of me to get sober, and that was a big deal for me. I grew up in, like I said, domestic violence, and part of the domestic violence that I grew up in is that my ancestry can be traced back to Nazi Germany, and in fact, from what I've been told, I haven't investigated this yet fully and completely, but I understand that one of my great uncles was on Adolf Hitler's SS. I don't fully know what that is, and I don't want to, but I grew up in a lot of violence, and women were considered subhuman. Both of my sisters had their heads shaved and were beaten and tortured, and so was I. And so to come out and say that I was an alcoholic wasn't a matter of coming out of the delusion. It was like I didn't have the right to be one because I was subhuman. And so it took a lot for me to do that. And when I got sober, I didn't have the alcohol, and I was then started chewing Nicorette gums and smoking at the same time. And so I was just overdosing on nicotine everywhere, which was really good. And I nearly died because that'll do that to you. And ending up in the ER one day, and they got tubes in me and drips and oxygen and all that stuff, and they can't work out what's wrong because I've collapsed because they're doing brain scans on my brain to try and work out what's wrong. And one of the nurses picked up on the smell on my breath of how intense it was, and she asked me, and I told her what I was doing, And she then just told me that nicotine is actually poison, and she told me everything, you know, arsenic and all those yummy yums. And I'm like, well, yeah, no, I get it, you know, but ain't gonna stop me, you know. And there is this arsenic, and there's all sorts of chemicals in it, strychnine, and they use the same chemicals that they use to make dishwashing liquid. It's something phosphorus and all that stuff in it, and the amount that I was taking nearly put me in a coma. But that's okay. That's okay. Like, I'll keep going. Like, you know, you're going to have to give me a really big reason to stop. And because I just can't, you know, because I think if you take away the nicotine, I'm going to be left with self. I'm going to be left with me. And I don't want to live with me. You got to be kidding me. Like, if you take that bitch, like, no one else wants to live with me. Why do you think I don't want to live with me? But, She still told me, and I left that hospital just mortified, because I there was no way I could keep on smoking with the information I had, but at the same time, I'm not going to give it up. Like, if you think I'm going to give up smoking without a packet of cigarettes in my hand, you're nuts. There's no way I'm going to give this thing up, because I love it, because I love that hit and the rush, and I love how important it makes me look. Oh, look at that. Especially when you get those black Russians in the cigarette holder, and you've got like the matching high heels and the matching boyfriend, the matching car, and it's all just filling that gap, you know. And I'm like, I ain't giving this up. And so I just, and that's how I went through most of my life, with this tug of war going on inside of me, knowing what it was doing to me, but not wanting to give it up, because I'm not a sociopath. I grew up, and I remember, you know, I had lungs at some stage, and there is a self-preservation, a survival instinct in me. I knew it was killing me, but at the same time, I don't want to give the world up, you know, all the glamour and all that stuff. And so eventually it got to a point where I had to, and I was forced into it. And I was in doing what was required of me to get sober for 19 years without any success. You may have picked up on that. And I just could not get sober. And then about 15 years ago, I was beaten by this illness, by alcoholism. And I crawled into that particular fellowship and died, literally laid there on the floor, and just thought, I've got nowhere else to go. And someone picked me up and started sponsoring me, and he'd been a smoker and he'd stopped. And that was one of the reasons why I stayed with him as a sponsor, because I wanted to know how you stayed sober and off nicotine as well, and not beating your wife, like, wow, and holding down a job, like, get out, like, how's he doing this? Like, he gets up every day and he goes to work, like, what? Come on, you know, like, I get if you're working in the porn industry, I can get it, and if you like snorting a bit of cocaine with your wife, I can spit, like, what the hell? And he just blew my mind, and I followed him around like he was some kind of deity. I just couldn't believe it. He did not smoke, and here where I am, that's really unusual to see someone sober and not smoking. And he'd say, well, if you want what I got, do what I've done. I want what you've got. I want to stay stopped. I want to stop smoking one day. And, you know, maybe this is what did it. But then one day I had a mini stroke and I woke up in hospital, and they said, well, I asked what was wrong, and they said, you've had a mini stroke. And I said, okay, so what's caused it? And he looked me dead in the eye, and without any hesitation and without looking at my file, he said, it's because you smoke. When I asked him how he could tell that, he said, because you're 41 years old and that's the only reason someone of your age could have a stroke. And for the first time in my life, I think because I'd surrendered around alcohol, I asked him what the solution was, and he came back and he said, stop smoking. Yeah, I know, normies. They complicate it, don't they? Stop smoking. I was kind of hoping for something like exercise or like a, you know, move into state, you know, like alcoholic, but it didn't. No, just stop. And like I said, I surrendered. And so I think that's why I just said, okay. And I just left that hospital a non-smoker, and I literally just left there, and I thought, that's it, because I was destroyed. I really believe that what had happened is I was destroyed, and it talks about this in the book that our program is adapted from, when it's total destruction of self, and there was nothing left, and nowhere to go, and nobody, and I just smoked myself out of the life, and my family was still in my life, they were all still abusing me. It was just like, it was just this rotating schedule of who was going to abuse me next. You know, they're all my father was probably a psychopath, and so was one of my sisters probably. And so my life was just a mess. And because I had a mini stroke, I couldn't do what was required of me to stay sober. I had to stay home. And I came on the internet actually looking for that fellowship, and I couldn't find it because, you know, I wasn't smoking, and I just doing the best that I can, and the computer was about to go through the window, and I just fell down on my knees and I asked for help, looking for, you know, that fellowship, and this fellowship came up on the screen. And I thought, oh, there'll probably be some alcoholics there. And I came, that's why I came in here. And then I loved the name Voices of Nicotine Recovery. I thought, whoa, yeah, because I've got a voice. I'm going to tell them how to do this 24 hours, you know. And the other thing is I had was NRT. I had nicotine replacement therapy, like my life depended on it. And I didn't go for those little wanky patches. No, I would have killed someone. I'm not waiting for something to go through my skin and then into my blood. I got one of those little inhalers, and you put the little canister of nicotine in it and you just suck the guts out of it. That's the best I can do. And I don't apologize for that, because I've now got something like 13 and a half years. So I'm not apologizing for anything I've done in this fellowship, unless I have directly harmed someone. And I don't believe that I have. I discussed that with my sponsor and there hasn't been. So, but I came in here with that inhaler and I literally just, and I chewed through it. I used to have to buy a new thing because I, you know, the little holder, because I'd snap it between my teeth because I'm so happy. And I'd sit in these meetings and I just hated your guts, and I just, God, if you're alive, I'd stab you. Because for the first time in my life, I had absolutely nothing between me and me, and it was just me. And I was sitting there staring at this computer screen, like, and at least in a face-to-face meeting you can like stare at people to make them feel like shit, but you got to sit in these meetings, the only thing you can do is stare at someone's neck, and they don't know that you hate them unless you send them a whisper. And it was just awful. It was so frustrating, and so no one knew how much you were hated. And so this, you know, you got nowhere to put it, and you know, you can't go out in the break and gossip about her, and you can't, you know, wait, go for coffee after the meeting and get to know him. So there I was, you know, in these meetings, and I just hated them. And all I wanted to do was get out and get off face to face, but I couldn't, you know, just couldn't walk because of the stroke. And I just sat here, and I thought, and it was best thing I reckon that I believe that could have happened to me. It was just what someone like me needed, because there was nowhere to go, and I just had to sit here and face me. And it was just ugly, and I got to know the person that I really was, and as painful it was, it answered a lot of questions. And just being in an online meeting without all the distractions of a face-to-face, like I said, I got to know me. And a really interesting thing happened, because I thought when I did my fourth step that there would be this immense list of people that I resented, and I believe if I hadn't come into an online meeting that would have been a very long list. But what happened is, sitting here for those few months before I got to inventory, I saw that how my behaviour caused a lot of those problems that caused those resentments. And that was such a gift, because I really believed that I'd been doing face-to-face. I never would have seen that, because I wouldn't have had the isolation, and I wouldn't have just been sitting here with my feelings the way I was. And it did. It reduced my four step down to about one third of what I thought I was going to put on it. And it was almost a daily thing of, oh my God, I'm sorry. Oh my God, I'm sorry. I did it to this person. I did it to that person. And it was an awakening. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful for online meetings for that purpose. And I'm not saying that face-to-face are a distraction and they're very necessary for our recovery, but I'm just saying that there's a particular advantage for me sitting in an online meeting. So when I got to face myself and I saw that I was the problem, I felt that I was set free from me, and I got to see that I was my problem my whole life. And even when it came to being abused, I was the problem, because it wasn't what they were doing to me, it was my relationship to it. And my relationship to it is I want revenge. And when I want revenge, I stay trapped. I might as well just go and move in with the person who's abusing me and just stay there. Because when I'm holding that revenge, holding that resentment, I'm reliving whatever they've done to me. And when I'm reliving it that way, there is no other out for me other than smoking. And I will either go crazy, shoot myself, or smoke. So I have to come out of it. I have to. I don't have a choice. And that's why I'm so grateful for this program, because it brought me out of self. It got me out of those resentments. And I can't, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that will help me get out of self. I've got an amazing counselor these days for abuse, and she, you know, I can talk to her and I can get out of self. But being an addict, I'll take myself back into it. And, you know, I can go do yoga, and I don't knock yoga. It's helped a lot of people, you know, people that have been in car accidents and trauma. It helps a lot of people, and I don't knock it. But for me, it will not work. Maybe it's working for you, but it will not work for me, because I need something to get me out of self. The same with sport. I can go and play a game of squash, and it will make me feel amazing. It will lift me out of self, and I will feel incredible, and I'll feel on fire, because the adrenaline will going, and there's that achievement pride, and I'll be interacting with other people. I'll have goals. I'll feel amazing, but it will not bring me out of self to the point that I need to be set free from the mental obsession. For that, I need a power greater than myself. And the only way I know, well, there are other ways. The one that I know that works best for me has been these 12 steps and traditions and everything else that's a part of this program. When I practice this program, it seems to me that what happens is I'm confronted with myself, and I'm confronted with a series of choices, and I'm given pain, which I can't feel when I'm smoking, and that is just such a positive for someone like me. And I can feel that pain. I go, well, choice A is going to hurt and choice B isn't going to hurt. Which one's it going to be? And after a while, what happened for me, I don't know what's happening for you, and I'm not here to interfere with that, but what happened for me was, after a while, I didn't have to have that pain. I just developed something that's called a conscience. I started to recognize the difference between right and wrong, and that was something that I never, ever, ever had in my life, because I was a spoilt brat. That's what I was. That's generally, that's in my view, is what addiction is. It's that we don't grow up, we become spoilt brats. And to add to that is the kind of domestic violence I grew up in. I was allowed to do whatever I wanted. I was also allowed to commit violence, like quite harmful violence to people. In fact, when I lived in Europe, I was involved in something where it was just so normal for me to own handguns, you know, and I shot a couple of people. I mean, and that's not a lie. I did. I didn't kill anyone. I didn't know people in these fellowships that have been to prison for murder. I didn't kill anyone, but I've shot people, you know, and that's part of it, you know, because I was just so out of control and so spoiled, and that sense of entitlement that I had. And I also stabbed a number of people too, which is why when I was well enough to go to face, my sponsor wouldn't take me to them, because I wouldn't give up my weapon. And that was one of the things he said to me, you know, come and pick me up. And he'd say, are you willing to give what's in your hand bag to me? And I'd say no. And then he'd sort of turn the corner and drive the other way and take me back to his place and put me in front of these god-awful, boring videos until eventually I thought, fine, I'd rather go and do a meeting. And then I gave him what was in my handbag. And so very self-centered, really wrapped up in self, very difficult to come out of it. But this fellowship and these principles, I believe it's working. One, because I no longer carry weapons of any kind, none at all. I have none in my home. And the thought of having one is to me just abhorrent. I couldn't imagine to have such a thing in my home today. It would feel like I'd have to, I just couldn't do it. And so it feels to me like my whole way of thinking has changed. And the best thing is that my relationship to my family has changed. And I used to think, and I hear this a lot in 12-step meeting fellowships, that, oh, I've forgiven my family. And last week I went to my sister's wedding, and next week I'm having Christmas lunch. And I listen to that and I think, I'm going to hang myself. I'm not doing that. And this is what I believe. And if what's working for you, I'm not here to interfere with that. But this is what worked for me, as I drew a line. And I said, none of you are allowed to cross this line. And if you come anywhere near me, I will turn you into the police and I will defend myself against you. And in fact, I took boxing lessons and did some other self-defense courses to learn how to defend myself against my family, because I've discovered that the right thing to do with abusers is not to live with them, not to counsel them, not to try and bring them to meetings, but to get yourself safe. And maybe once you're safe, and if you still want to bring them to a meeting, great. But in my view, what will happen if you try and get involved in their recovery before you're recovered yourself, they will bring you down. And so they are out of my life, completely out of my life. And I am so grateful for that I've got freedom today. And I believe that the reason why I'm free of my family is because this program offers me, if I participate in it, freedom from the bondage of self. I can actually have freedom from me, from my ideas and my thinking that take me back to those situations where I'm going to get hurt. And I am so grateful for that. That's my timer that's gone off. It's been 30 minutes. I don't think, I guess Sarah should share any more than that. I remember when I was new and 30 minutes and I was just ready to get up and walk out. It's a lot to ask someone to sit and listen to. So I am so grateful to be here, and I'm so grateful for everything this program has given me. I had once, when I first came in, this woman said that the program gave back to her what she had before she started smoking. And I'm not knocking her. I mean, obviously that was true for her, but it's not true for me. One, I'd be 9 years old. I don't want what I had when I was 9 years old. And the other thing is that if it gave me back what I had before I started smoking, all I would have is freedom from nicotine, and anyone can do that. What I feel like this program has given me is life. I feel like I've got a life, like a real life. The people that I hang out with today just blow my mind. I'm Roman Catholic. I followed the directions in this book, and where it said that most of our members favour a religion, I followed that. And I went and joined a religion, not because I'm a religious person, but because the book told me to do it. And I wasn't willing to argue with anything for where I was at. And so today, some of my friends are some of the world's leading theologians. And we hang out together on Twitter and on Facebook. And I can't do it live because they don't live where I live. They live overseas, and they want to hang out with me. Like, they want to, you know, and that, I believe, water seeks its own level. And if I wasn't in the same headspace as they were, they wouldn't want to be with me. And that's how I can tell that this program's done something for me. And I'm so, so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful for everyone that's coming for me and made this possible. Thanks. Go ahead.